I arrived back about, let me see, I think it was about 5:30 or 6 o'clock this morning, London time. I finally got to bed about midnight our time, after quite a long flight from London. So I think, first of all, perhaps you'd like to hear a little about the trip. I was a little impressed by one thing said by Mr. McNair in the opening prayer about how this land has been blessed above all lands. Now, on this trip, I spent a few days in Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been called the glory of all lands. But do you know that our United States of America in our lifetime has been blessed above the land of Israel and above Jerusalem? And right now that is the trouble spot of the world, and is going to be the trouble spot of the world until Christ comes to put the fire out. I just had to recall that this country has been blessed above every other country in the world. And I wonder if you know why. Now, this afternoon, I have no prepared sermon at all. I just arrived back late last night. As I say, we'd been, you might say, traveling all night on the plane because it was about 5 or 6, 5:30 or 6 or something like that in the morning when we arrived here. By London time, by the time we'd been on for several days. And even later than that, a few days before when we came from Cairo and Jerusalem. And, of course, a trip like that is a very tiresome trip. You have to get over a jet lag, because you arrive here after you've been up all night, and then it's just time to go to bed and sleep another night. Going the other way, you get it just the opposite. We left here, I believe it was about noon, and inside of about a couple of hours, the sun had set and it was dark, because the sun was traveling this way and we were going the other way. We were going about as fast toward the east as the sun seemed to be going toward the west. And then we were all night on the plane arriving. I think we arrived at this time about 4 o'clock in the morning in London, London time. Or not London, we landed actually out at Luton, quite a ways north of London. But we prefer to land out at that airport. It's so much easier to get through customs, immigration, and everything out there. And then my car can drive out and right to the airplane there, and of course that can't happen if we go into London at the Heathrow Airport. They have to send the bus out for us, and we go through a lot of regulations to get through immigration and then customs before you get in, and then it still is almost as long to get into London because there's heavier traffic as it is on the motorway, as they call it over there. We call it freeways here. Into London from out in Luton, which is the other side of Brickett Wood, by some little distance. Anyway, I think I'll tell you first about the trip, and then I want to get back to some other things that I think we need right now. This world is in a very upset and disturbed condition. You stay here in this beautiful city, and we talk as if it's a terrible thing to have some rain out there. That's a great blessing. The sun is still shining, you know. It's just filtered sunshine. The sun is still shining up above those clouds, just the same as always. And it's a great blessing to have that rain. If there are any forest fires, that'll help put them out. The people up in Oregon really rejoice when they get a little bit of rain. Let me see, someone in the morning service talked about that. It seemed like Oregon again. someone who had been up there. Up there, they just enjoy the rain. Which all reminds me of how we're inclined to be like the ancient Israelites. They were grumbling and complaining. The Bible calls it murmuring all the time. They had to criticize, find fault. Everything was wrong. They were discontented. You know, we're their great-great-great-great-grandchildren, and we seem to still be the same way. We don't appreciate the things we have, but we grumble about even the good things we have. We find fault. And I notice how we disobey another thing in the Scripture that says we should rejoice in good things and believe the best instead of the worst. But we seem to want to believe the worst. If there's some bad news or someone does something wrong, the rumors will fly all over the United States about it. If something really good happens, it's never mentioned. When I said something about female makeup, and I just happened to think of it right in the middle of a sermon, and I let it go, on the Sabbath during the Feast of Tabernacles when I was speaking over at Big Sandy. By the next day, what I said was known all over the United States. Women who didn't like what I said saw to it. They got on the telephone. They spent their money for long-distance telephone calls to get the news out to others, the bad news. Good news, we never gossip about. Did you ever think of that? Rumors are always bad news. Shame on us! What's the matter with us, brethren? Jesus Christ has been trying to clean up this church the last 3 years through me. And that's one thing that needs to be cleaned up. And all you, brethren, need to clean up your minds. If there's some bad news, you've got to get on the telephone. You've got to spread it everywhere. We're just like the Israelites of old. We complain. We grumble. We want to talk about the bad news. We should rejoice in the good news. If we want to spread rumors about something good instead of something bad about people. Well, to get back to our trip, we arrived in London on, was it Thursday or Friday morning? Anyway, we had a meeting over there. Our minister from New Zealand, the head of our office there, and also Herr Schnee, the head of our office in Germany, came over to have reports and talks with me. I spoke to a united congregation in London of more than 1,000 people on the Sabbath. That was 2 weeks ago today, I believe. And then on Monday, we flew on. I stopped off to have a board meeting of the King Leopold III Foundation of Belgium, of which I happen to be a member, and had luncheon with King Leopold and his wife, Princess Lillian. The others in the plane went into Belgium. I think they had luncheon, into Brussels. They had lunch in Brussels, did a little shopping for lace or some things like that that some of the ladies in the party wanted to buy. If you're ever in Brussels, that's a place to find some of the most beautiful lace. And then we were back at the plane about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We flew on to Jerusalem that night. And Beginning Tuesday morning, I had many things to do in Jerusalem. I believe it was that night they had a special performance for me at the ICCY building, which is a special three-story building that we are supporting. It's the International Cultural Center for Youth. We are in that organization bringing the young people, especially teenagers, of the Arabs and of the Israelis together. And they both performed for me again, as they did the year before and have done many times in previous years, especially when we've sent a lot of students over to work in the archaeological project over there. And I had a very nice meeting with President Navon on Friday. He had been on Tuesday in Cairo, where he had a meeting with the new president, Mubarak, and also he had gone especially for a meeting, a sort of condolence meeting, with Mrs. Sadat, the widow of the very recently assassinated President Sadat. Now, a year ago, I had quite a meeting with President Sadat, and that was televised, and many of you have seen it. It was on the air here on our program and some of our other televised pictures. And anyway, he asked me, even though he had just returned from Jerusalem, I was going over, and he asked me to carry his best wishes to President Mubarak and also to Mrs. Sadat, both of whom I saw in Cairo. So we went on over to Cairo, and there I had a meeting on the first morning after our arrival with the new president, Mubarak. I met with Dr. Hatem first. And Dr. Hatem is the third man in power in Egypt, only behind the president and the prime minister. And he used to be the president and the vice president, and there was no prime minister. I know the first time I met Dr. Hatem, he received a telegram during our conversation. He looked at it and he smiled and he said, "Well," he says, "I just had word I'm the prime minister." He said, "President Sadat," and this was a few years ago, he said, "President Sadat, according to this wire, just arrived in Syria. When he's out of this country, I'm the prime minister. When he returns, I won't be prime minister any longer." Because at that time, the president acted as president, prime minister, and everything. So they had a vice president. And when President Sadat was assassinated, about a month ago, I think, the vice president, Mubarak, took the office. They had a quick election, and I think he received about 99%+ of the vote, and he is the president for the time being. There's to be another election after a certain time, but I think that is one or two or more years off. Anyway, I had a nice talk with him. He was a little shy and bashful and appeared not to be too warm, but a little stiff at first. However, you'll see the whole conversation. Either a week from Sunday or 2 weeks from Sunday, it will be on the air here. I'm going to make a whole television program out of that meeting. Our television crew was over there. And President Mubarak warmed up as we talked. He warmed up to me and became very, very friendly. And he assured me that he is going to continue on President Sadat's efforts at peace with Israel and through the United States and their peace project at Mount Sinai. And, of course, I've heard a lot of talk on other sides about it. I found that in Cairo, in top circles even, that there is some skepticism as to whether he will be able to really hold the country. I find now many different versions of what happened in the assassination of President Sadat. I'll come to a little more of that as I go along. But I've had a lot of first-hand information that you don't get in the newspapers. First from Dr. Haddam, who was just the Vice President, Mubarak, as he was at the time, was standing or sitting, but they had risen to stand at the time because the airplanes were going over. The whole thing was planned in advance and very professionally timed. The shooting took place while the jet planes were going over, making a big roaring noise, as jet planes do. And they were flying low, so the noise, and purposely so that the noise would be almost deafening. They were looking up, and I saw pictures over there that were not in the newspapers here. President Sadat was looking up, and down below were the men coming and shooting. And I saw the pictures of the whole thing. And Vice President Mubarak was standing right next to him. He was grazed in one hand with a bullet, and that's all. And I didn't notice anything wrong. It must have been just a very slight thing, because I didn't even notice a bandage on his hand. And next to him was Dr. Haddam. And he escaped without any trouble. He's the one who yelled out immediately for the ambulance to get President Sadat to a hospital. So I had his version of it. And then later, the morning that we left, I had a very nice visit with Mrs. Sadat in the Giza Palace, in the same room exactly, where I met her husband, President Sadat, a year ago. Many of you have seen that interview or portions of it on our television program. Now, at that time, Mrs. Sadat had met me at the car, took me by the arm, escorted me in. President Sadat, well, I have to go back a little bit. I had been over in a building where President Sadat was giving a national television and radio address to the nation. There was an auditorium on the ground floor, an office building above, and I was up in an office at the top of the office building. At the end of the address, I came down, our party, and we were escorted to a car immediately behind President Sadat's car. In between his car and ours was an ambulance. Wherever President Sadat went, the ambulance went with him just behind his car. In it was a physician and a nurse with equipment and everything, anticipating an assassination. And there was a siren car ahead and a motorcycle escort with sirens blasting out. And we were rushed through the streets from this place, this auditorium and office building, on over to the Giza Palace. President Sadat got out of the car first, rushed into the palace to meet a visiting delegation of American congressmen. And he had to see them first. Mrs. Sadat came out, took me by the arm, escorted me into the house and into a salon off of the entering grand lobby or hall or whatever you call it, and talked with us for quite a while, about 15 minutes or so, until President Sadat came in. He got rid of the congressman as soon as he could to come in and talk to me. Then, of course, she very graciously retired. But I had become by that time well acquainted with her, and so I wanted to have a meeting with her this time. I sent her a telegram on the very day of the assassination, and I knew that she would remember me. Now, incidentally, I had talked to Dr. Hannum about one thing. I said, did not President Sadat have quite an armed escort there? How does it happen that those men were able to come right up? And I could see them running up before the stands with their gun just ready to shoot. And he says, no, there was no armed guard. President Sadat said, this is a military parade. All these, no one will be there except my own soldiers. They're my own sons. They all love me. I don't need an armed escort. But it was one of those sons who loved him who shot him. Or, as a matter of fact, it was about three or four of them. I don't know which one shot him. It just shows you that in these days and ages, you can't trust your own son. You can ask any police chief, and he'll tell you that the largest portion of murders occur in the home. Children shooting parents, parents shooting, brother shooting sister, husband or wife shooting each other. That's true in almost any good big city in the United States. I think it's true in big cities in other countries as well. But I know it's notoriously true in this country, as any police chief will tell you. Anyway, President Sadat had no guard, no protection whatever. It shows you can't trust anybody in this world. Well, I had a visit with Mrs. Sadat. I came to know her better than I ever had before. I spoke with her for about 45 minutes. And I had heard that she did not wish to discuss the assassination with anybody. It was such a terrible shock to her that she didn't want to discuss it. But to my surprise, she opened up and told me all the details of it. She was in the stand with two of her grandchildren. And one of her grandchildren, a little boy, a year and a half old, was brought in by a maid while we were talking. And he came up and kissed me on the cheek. And she kept him there for the rest of the interview. But she went into all of the details and told me she was right there in the stand with two grandchildren. She might have been about the second row. There were about three or four rows of people in the reviewing stand with the president. Nevertheless, her maid was with her and shoved her down onto her, well, not only the hands and knees, but clear down flat on the platform immediately with the first shot, and threw herself on her own body on top of Mrs. Sadat and the grandchildren to protect them. And they were spared. Mrs. Sadat is half English and half Arab. But she seems to be more English than Arab. She is not like an Arab. She is a most unusual woman. I've met many of the head women of the world. I had a long talk with Golda Meir when she was Prime Minister of Israel. Also with Indira Gandhi, the Prime Minister of India, the second largest country in the world. Also a long talk in her own home with Mrs. Vandranaike, who was the Prime Minister of Sri Lanka. And I know, of course, I know Mrs. Marcos, the First Lady of the Philippines. And beside Princess Lillian, the wife of King Leopold, also Princess Grace of Monaco, who sat next to me at a banquet one time where I was co-host, and her husband sat across from me. And the custom in Europe and the Middle East and the East is the host and the second man will always sit in the middle of the table across from each other, not at the end of the table. So Prince Rainier and I were the co-hosts, and he sat opposite me, but his wife, Princess Grace, sat on my left, and I had quite a conversation with her. She's a very charming lady, by the way, and a very accomplished... She may have been a movie star, but she came from a very fine family, I understand, and is quite an accomplished woman. So I have known some of those women, and I think that a meeting is being planned for me to have a meeting either on my next trip, late January or February, or at least next summer, with the Prime Minister of England, Mrs. Thatcher. And it just occurred to me that perhaps I should write a book on the women that are heading governments in the world these days. You know what Isaiah says in the third chapter, that in these last days that women would be our rulers. And indeed, they're becoming that. Don't be surprised if we have a woman president next. Because Teddy Kennedy's already made a try at it and he missed out. Maybe some woman will beat him to it next time. Mr. Reagan said he's only running for one term, that he intended to be a one-term president. At least he made that statement during the campaign before he was elected. I don't know what he'll decide now. If his popularity is still good, that's going to be quite a temptation to run again. Well, after we left Cairo, we flew on to Geneva, had to have a conference with our office there and our manager, and we were there overnight. And then on the way to London early in the morning, and I had to be up from 3 o'clock in the morning on to make all of the connection, we stopped off in Munich, where I had decided that I would like to have another talk with the strong man of Europe, Franz Josef Strauss. He has wanted to be the Chancellor of West Germany and has never made it. He was a guest in my home here 10 years ago. At dinner that evening, he had spoken, I believe he spoke to our students during the day, and he was all over the campus, and had dinner in my home that evening with his wife and his bodyguard, who was along with him. He carried an armed bodyguard everywhere he went. And I had talked with him in the library of my home. I knew that he wanted so much to be chancellor. I said, "Dr. Strauss, you, in my judgment, are not going to be chancellor of West Germany, but a greater office is waiting for you." And then I made a comment about it when it happens. You'll find the greater office described in the 17th chapter of Revelation as the man at the head of the government called the beast. And the beast will be a union of the nations of Europe. And I believe it'll probably be 5 nations in Western Europe and 5 satellite nations that are going to break loose from Russia in Eastern Europe. And the best candidate to head that group of 10 nations is Franz Josef Strauss, in my judgment. Now, some people think that, what is his name? Von Habsburg. of Austria might lead it. Now, he has written a book of the program and the design for a united Europe, but also Franz Josef Strauss has, and his book is called The Grand Design. Well, I wanted to talk to him again, and I was quite impressed. That was just day before yesterday morning. And why he is called the strong man of Europe. He is a very powerful man, a very vigorous, positive speaker. He had just returned the day before from having, the day before that, or 2 days before I saw him, a private interview with President Brezhnev of Russia. And I was met at the airport in Munich by Herr Frank Schnee, our manager of our office in Bonn for Germany, and also with Mrs. Hennig, who is the wife of the official photographer of the West German government, and also happens to be a photographer for the Worldwide Church of God. And we share the West German government in paying his salary. And Frau Hennig had come along to bring me two nice large pictures taken by her husband of just the day before, when Franz Josef Strauss was having a private meeting with President Brezhnev from Moscow, which I presented to Dr. Strauss. And in the course of our conversation, I mentioned to him that I had thought of the possibility of a meeting with Brezhnev. I said, "Dr. Strauss, what do you think? Should I have a meeting with him? Can it be arranged?" He says, "Perhaps it could be arranged, but you shouldn't have it." He says, "I have learned something about Brezhnev, and I know the Russians backwards and forwards. When you meet Brezhnev, he will have what he's going to say to you all written out. He will read it, and it'll be in Russian. You won't understand a word he said, and they say, 'Now, I want your reply. Now, you answer.' And he's very dominant, very gruff. He says, 'Nothing could be accomplished in speaking to him. I could accomplish nothing. Nobody can.' There is one man who knows the communist whole philosophy, their plan, their objectives, their methods of accomplishing those objectives. Now, President Carter, when he was in office, did not understand the communists or Russia at all. He began to learn a little about it, especially after the captivity of our diplomatic people in Iran. And he was surprised. He didn't know anything about Russia. I have known it for 55 years. 55 years ago, the Communist Party in the United States had a home study course in communism. They were very careful to give it only to people that they thought they already had on their side and would study it from their point of view. I received it from a man who posed as a plainclothes detective and had an office in the police building of Portland, Oregon. Was actually an FBI man. And I happened to know him very well when I was up in Eugene, Oregon in those days. And he supplied me with that 55 years ago. And I know the subtle means of communism. I'll just say this. They are aiming at nothing less than world domination. They admit that communism has not worked, and they say it cannot work until the whole world is under its sway. That explains why their people are not living as well as the people in the free world. They have their explanation of things of that sort. And in the meantime, they're working, first of all, by propaganda. And they are the most clever propagandists in the world. They work through university students and university professors. They believe that the end justifies the means. Now, the means can be lying, deception, pretense, anything whatsoever that will accomplish their result. Anything dishonorable, anything wrong, anything evil is justified because they must rule the world, and that is the big thing that counts. They don't believe in religion anyway. Religion, they call the opiate of the public, of the people. And as a matter of fact, the religions of this world pretty much are, because they're not the religions of the eternal God. Of course, the Russians don't know that. They do know what's wrong with the religions of this world. They just don't know the truth. I don't think they would accept it if they knew it, because their hearts are evil. But I was surprised at the grasp of the world situation that Franz Josef Strauss knows. Now, I was allowed to take my executive assistant, Bob Fay, with me. I had on the trip with me also Mr. Jane Hogberg, who is our news analyst in our news bureau here on campus. And I very much wanted him to go, but I could only take one man, and I felt that I had to take Mr. Fay. But he was surprised as well as I at how knowledgeable Dr. Strauss is in the world condition. The Russians are not deceiving him at all. He knows them. He knows what is up. Now, one thing he said that might shock you a little. He said that the three assassination attempts, first on President Reagan, secondly on Pope John Paul II, but both of them survived the attempt, and thirdly on President Sadat, every one were done by individuals who had no official connection, were not members of any group or anything like that, and so everyone thinks it was just a crackpot man doing it. He says that is not altogether true. The communists know just how to work, and they have had men who did not pose as communists, but who worked on these individuals who did the shooting and influenced them into being puppets and willing to do this thing, and use every psychology on them to get them to do it. If you will study the assassinations of history and the men who have done the assassinating, you will find that usually they're very small, short men. They're men who are nothing and nobody in the world, but who want to be somebody, and they want to do a thing like that because they know it's going to make them famous. And they're willing to pay the price and be killed themselves afterward in order to do it. That was true of John Wilkes, wasn't it, that shot President Lincoln. That's been true of the other assassins that we've had all the way along. It was true of the one who assassinated President Kennedy, a little man who had been to Russia and had a lot of communist connections. And I think now, more than ever, there's no doubt that that was really a communist attempt. When President Reagan began to show that he was the first president we've had in some time who was firm and who would not be budged, Dr. Strauss says the Kremlin decided he must go. They influenced the young man who did it. And the young man who did it doesn't know it was communism that influenced him. He doesn't realize what happened to him. When the Pope at Rome made his visit over to Poland, and he's a Polish Pope, that was beginning to turn the Poles away from communism. And you know what's been happening lately if you've been reading the newspapers. And the Russians don't know quite how to handle that situation in Poland right now. They decided the Pope had to go. The man who did it is not a communist. He doesn't know he has any communist connections. When Anwar Sadat kicked the Russians out of Egypt, they decided Sadat had to go. Now I'll tell you something else. The assassination of Anwar Sadat was on the precise anniversary, 8th anniversary of 8 years from the time that he was holding a celebration when he, you might say, pushed the magic button that opened the Holy Day War against Israel. The precise anniversary of Sadat starting the war against Israel. Now later, Anwar Sadat changed and went over on a peace mission. He turned to peace. But I don't know. The Arab mind doesn't work like ours. And here's something else that I had not read in any newspaper report in this country till I got over there. Anwar Sadat was shot during a memorial parade, a military parade that was a military celebration, and was a celebration which the Arabs over there regarded as a victory in that war. They were winning that war until the last few days. The last few days, the Israelis turned the tide completely, but they were caught off guard. The Israelis were not ready. Moshe Dayan had won the previous war, the Six-Day War, but Moshe Dayan was caught napping and was not prepared. And Sadat's forces attacked Israel on the Day of Atonement, which to them is the most solemn day of the year as a holy day, and they were caught napping. And indeed, the Egyptians were well toward winning that war the first several days. But then the Israelis caught up with them and were driving them back. And they had driven them back across the Suez Canal. And the Israelis were on the Egyptian side of the Suez Canal.